welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning, Imperial Valley. You are listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, for Imperial and Mexicali Valleys. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingüe. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good, good. Good to go. Good to go. Ready for the listeners?
School has started.
No kidding. I ran in like a traffic jam coming to the station this morning. Welcome back, high schoolers.
I know.
I love your little insolent stroll across the street while I'm trying to get somewhere on time.
today's guest, we have the Honorable Judge Juan Ulloa. Good morning. Good morning. And today we're going to be talking about juvenile court. And it's very, you know, when we talk about judges and courts, we always think about adults, the criminals and all those high, the crimes. But we tend to forget that there is a juvenile court.
Yeah, and part of that is because a juvenile court is confidential, so you can't read about what happens in court in the newspaper. And a lot of the families that are involved in juvenile court feel that that's personal, private business, so they don't share. But there's a lot of interest in it. And, it's something that the public ought to know more about.
For me, I came to work for Behavioral Health 12 years ago, I never had heard that there was a juvenile court. And that's one of the purposes here for the radio show is to let the public know that there is a juvenile court. You know, unless you personally are involved with it, you would know about it. But other than that, luckily I was lucky enough not to be involved in the juvenile court system when I was younger, so.
You escaped the jurisdiction.
Yes, I did.
Well, you know, the first thing that people think about in juvenile court is juveniles committing crimes. And that is part of what we do. But a very large part of the juvenile court's business is families in crisis where children are neglected, abused, or abandoned. And everyone has heard about, you know, the stories of the social worker taking your children away. And that's part of the juvenile court's business is to oversee that. We have three jurisdictions under the Welfare and Institutions Code. Section 300 has to do with neglected and abused children. Section 600 has to do with delinquent children, or the children who commit crimes or do acts that would be crimes if they were adults. And then we hear a lot less about status offenders, truants, and incorrigibles, and that is where young people haven't committed offenses, but refuse to obey their parents, refuse to go to school, things like that. We have a lot less tools in that area, and we don't have a lot of action, but there are efforts afoot to start prosecuting status offenders. And it's an interesting thing because there, juveniles can be prosecuted as status offenders, but parents can be prosecuted as well for not supporting their children and not taking them or forcing them to go into school. So it's a kind of a dual thing that the schools and the district attorney's office is looking into, and we're participating in some discussions with them about how that could happen.
Yeah, and we're going to have next month Selena Gonzalez and Assistant District Attorney Eileen Cavill here in the show, and they're going to be talking about the kids and the parents.
Well, I better listen because so far I don't know what they're up to.
So it'll be interesting, and I think they've gotten a good response when parents get letters from the district attorney saying, your son/daughter has not gone to school and...
Right. Comes on really high-grade paper, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, with letterhead and everything, very formal.
The fact is that families may take it lightly, but the schools are losing millions of dollars of money in ADA. And when a child is not at school, the school's not getting paid, and so they can't provide the opportunity for other children to go to school. So they just cannot ignore it.
Yeah. You know, in these days of limited resources, you begin to manage every single penny, and so certainly school attendance becomes one way that happens.
Absolutely.
And And if the parent ignores that letter from the district attorney, they'll end up standing in front of you.
Perhaps.
So we're here today with the Honorable Judge Ulloa, who is the judge of the juvenile court. And juvenile courts are confidential, so we're not reading about this in the paper. But as you described it, basically any family that's in crisis or any child that is either having a welfare problem or a criminal problem is not really fitting in very well to society knows about your court.
Actually, a lot less know about it maybe than should, but juvenile court is one place where the government system really comes together. We have jurisdiction over families in crisis, mm-hmm. but at the same time, we also are responsible for getting services. So we're collaborating, forming connections with behavioral health services and different programs that they offer. The Department of Social Services has different programs, and then there are private services that we're looking for all the time to address needs. We have a couple of goals. The primary goal is to have children be at home with their families and be safe. So whether it's parents that are not taking steps to protect the children and provide for them that are in crisis, or where you have children who are resistant, oppositional, and committing crimes, harming others or, mm-hmm. or damaging property, those are families in crisis as well. And what we're trying to do is to have the entire family come into focus so that we can provide services and have long-lasting change.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just as simple as just taking somebody's kids away and putting them somewhere.
Somewhere else.
I don't know.
And then eventually they'll get better.
Well-raised children.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a perception, some of it is deserved because we have such few resources, but there's a perception that when children are removed, they're put in timeout somewhere while the parents perform, you know, plans, get mm-hmm. counseling, get services, and have a new perspective on how to raise their children. But we found that while those children are removed, they're also continuing to suffer injury and damage, and they have needs that have to be met as well.
Yes.
And that's been one of the challenges. Traditionally, the juvenile court, and I'll take responsibility for it. I'm there at the court to change this mindset, but traditionally, the juvenile court has had two complete mindsets on juveniles. Mm-hmm. When we remove children, we focus on parents and their needs. But when a child commits an offense, we focus on children and not the whole family's mm-hmm. needs. And we create an imbalance.
So in both cases, there's some paradox there.
That's right.
And and we're seeing that now. We provide services to the child, to the youth, and the youth might respond well to treatment, but then they go back and, you know, they might respond good in the session or while they're working with them, they go back home at night or at the end of the day to the parent, and they're in the families are very dysfunctional.
Consider the opposite. Let's have a preteen that's removed from the home. Mm-hmm. And the parents go through drug rehabilitation, they go to parenting counseling, they go to personal therapy, they go through all of these changes, they go through all this stress reduction and learn coping skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then the child comes back home and they need to now raise a teenager who's
never had the structure, who's never had
right, and who also knows that mom and dad are the defective ones because mm-hmm. the government said so, and so we create a whole new stress because we haven't involved the child in the parent's process at the time. So that's one of the things that we're trying to change is mm-hmm. keep it's sort of like an Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
We want to create a new sort of an expectation. I don't like, everybody uses the word paradigm. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that means. But
and I think it's like 20 cents or something.
Yeah,
right?
Something like that. But a new expectation that when we get involved with a family, mm-hmm. regardless of how we got there, that we need to assess the entire family's needs so that they can mm-hmm. be all together and safe and move on and be successful. Whether it's a child that committed an offense, you know, or parents who are so disabled
mm-hmm.
from parenting because of their issues. that they need help. But I have, for example, imagine we have a hypothetical child who commits the very first offense, and normally, you get their attention, you send them home, you give them a list of things, probation, you're going to behave, you're going to do this and that. When we look at the family, and there's dad has been in prison for drug trafficking, mom has been in jail for drug abuse, drug use, for theft, all the siblings have been in the criminal system, and we're sending a child home, wagging our finger and saying, you better behave.
But that's what he's learned. That's his life. That's his, the way, what he knows only. That's his life.
Right.
And how many times do we do that before we figure out that the odds of that magically occurring?
If the child comes in at 13 or 14, eventually they offend or violate supervision enough where they get into a residential program and maybe just do time or maybe get an education and move on. But that's very expensive. And so I think what we're trying to do now is say, let's look at this whole family and put the entire family on probation. Parents have drug issues, siblings have drug issues. If this child is going to live in this environment, then the environment needs to be safe. And we need everybody involved in this child's rehabilitation.
337-8874 is the phone number. You give the Honorable Judge Uyoha a call. We don't get a judge on this show very often. This is a really nice chance to end. With the proceedings at juvenile court being confidential, we don't really hear a lot about this. This is a great chance to weigh in on any questions you might have for the judge. 337-8874. Did you, when you were a little kid, did you grow up in the Imperial Valley? I mean, how did you become this the person with a finger in the dike of the legal system for families and children?
That's a good one right there.
I'm really curious.
My story is a story that's played out all over this country. It's a real American story. I mean, my parents came here as immigrant farm workers. I grew up on the farm. I was born in Meadowland, out in a ranch out there,
mm-hmm.
back when doctors used to make home visits.
And Meadowland is over here by Toyota.
Yeah, that's like one of the questions I have for Imperial Valley test is.
That's right.
Yeah.
In my life, I've traveled a total of about 4 miles. But, I had help from a lot of people. I managed to get into UC Riverside and UCLA Law School. I worked for California Rural Legal Assistance when I got out of law school.
Mm.
And then I had my own practice for a while, and I ran for judge
Judges and doctors. They can't turn
off
the phone.
I forgot to do that. I ran for judge in 1990 and lost a close election, and I was elected in 94. But in 1992, I was hired by the Superior Court to serve as juvenile court judge, referee. And so I've been in the juvenile court business since 1992. But
has it changed?
It has changed a lot. We've made a lot of changes, especially recently. The court nationwide is really a fairly new court. The mm-hmm. concept of a juvenile court really started in the middle 60s in Arizona, and then since then a lot of changes have been made mm-hmm. because as pressures in society have increased and traditional families have broken down I think before 1965 people had an expectation that you would live your whole life within mm-hmm. 20 miles of where you were born.
Mm-hmm.
But we're so mobile now.
As with your parents and your grandparents.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Your entire support structure would be there. How many adults remember the days when the whole neighborhood would be watching you if you misbehaved? And those things
only
don't
old
happen.
People, huh?
That's right. Young people don't have that experience or expectation.
Uh-huh.
And that caused a lot of stress on families, mm-hmm. and we've learned over the years different things. But the court has changed with the times. Traditionally, you hear about juvenile court when things go wrong, when a child dies in foster care or is abused in foster care, and those things happen. The government does take children from families and sometimes never turns them back. But now we come to the realization that the government isn't much good as a parent either. Children that are raised by the government have a lot of problems and end up having the government raise their children too.
At much higher cost.
At much higher cost, absolutely.
So the ideal thing is for parents to raise their own kids in a safe environment.
Absolutely. Our effort now is to put the highest priority in restoring families to safety. Mm-hmm. And ironically, it's brought us back to another point of view that's really one of the oldest point of views. Mm-hmm. Because of the Indian Child Welfare Act, we have the concept from Native Americans that family is more important than government, and their concept of family is tribal. Mm-hmm. And so when we have Native American children, we have to make special efforts to find family members, to find tribal members, to find people who have a predisposition to want to help the child. Well, that has led us to taking the same approach to non-tribal members. And now we're trying to build the capacity to do family searching at the beginning of a case to find supportive members of the community within the family or close to the family. In the past, we didn't make that kind of a search until we gave up on efforts to rehabilitate the family.
Yeah.
But, you know, even the worst families have two or three people who are willing to take in a child and help a child.
That's true.
And maybe put some indirect support into the parents to help assist their process.
Right. A perfect example of family finding and its effect. We recently had a demonstration by a family finding expert where we had five cases in which, as far as we know, these children had no family. With an internet search and some information about where the parents were born and their social security numbers, within a half an hour we found 50 family members.
Wow.
You know, and there was
at a minimum cost. I mean, those
it
even
costs $25.
Yeah, even if you go commercially on the internet, this stuff's not very expensive.
Wow.
But they've put entire town hall records of birth into the internet now.
Instead of sending them to a foster care or to a receiving home.
Right. Now we have family members that we're asking if they're want to become involved in either to support the family in their efforts or to take the child either temporarily or permanently. And what better placement for a child? We can get a foster placement and pay for a dependent child with no serious problems, $3,000 a month. For a delinquent child with probably oppositional issues and counseling and those other kinds of things, up to $6,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
For a child with medical, psychiatric, or therapeutic needs, up to $8,000-$9,000 a month. Or a relative will do it for nothing.
That adds up in a hurry.
Yeah.
How many kids do we have in the system? Is that something, as they go through your office, is that something you keep like a little scoreboard in the back of your chalkboard?
No, I don't. The departments do. I can't tell you right now how many we have in foster care and dependencies. A rough guess would be about 300 children.
Mm-hmm.
But we have about 700 in the system. And on the delinquency side, it's a little different. We probably have around 400, 450 in the system, of which about 75 or 100 are in placement, spending taxpayer money to support them and treat them.
So it's like 1,100, 1,200 kids all together. That's the population of size of school.
That's about that, I think.
Wow. If you put it like that, it's just a whole school. Imagine a whole school, all those kids.
There's teachers today imagining it's their school.
Yeah.
337-884-8874, teachers. Give us a call. We got Judge Ugola here with childhood, child court and juvenile court.
Are most of the kids that are removed from their parents, are they mostly majority because of the drug use?
I think most of the problems in society comes from drug and alcohol abuse. People don't decide one day to not feed their kids or not dress their kids or to start hitting their kids. Right now we have a crisis.
Or to stop raising their kids.
Exactly.
Ends up with delinquency problems.
We have a crisis right now because of drug and alcohol leading to domestic violence, leading to other crimes. So, yeah, I think that the majority of our cases, the core is drug and alcohol issues.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very limited number of cases where parents don't know how to care for their children.
Mm-hmm.
They just weren't raised right. That's not happening. I suppose there are a few where parents are so young that they haven't been raised themselves and they mm-hmm. don't know how to, you know, budget food for a month, things like that.
And we see that. I mean, I saw that trying to reunify the family at the perinatal program, and it's disappointing because it's going to be closing soon.
Well,
lack of funding. But you would see there when I was a substance abuse counselor, and I would go to perinatal in the summertime, you know, to help out and do groups and everything, and you would see these mothers coming in with their kids dirty. I mean, the kids smelled. Just the kids were not removed yet, but they were, you know, the mother was, you know, ordered to go to perinatal. And at the end of summer, these kids came in, you know, they weren't hungry, they weren't starving, because the first thing they would want is with snacks, you know, because we had like a little, you know, daycare there that we'd take care of them, you know, and the kids were starving. At the end of the summer, you know, when by the school started in September, you know, kids were coming in clean. You know, they had some shoes. The case manager, perinatal, would help them get clothes for the kids. They would, like, feed them. They came in clean. They didn't smell like they had soiled, you know, underwear. And mothers were learning there how to cook with limited amount of money. They taught them cooking classes. The mothers helped out in the daycare also. And you would see that change. I mean, you would... For me coming in, I remember that first year, I would say, how can mothers do that, you know? How can they choose a drug over their child? And that was for me, yes, and I'm thinking that that's the general, the way the general population thinks, you know, and I was like that, you know, how can they choose a drug over their child? Look at their child. It's all dirty, or they're dirty and they're starving and, you know, some have hit lice and was that, and at the end, it's the mother had changed completely after sobriety, having been sober. That was not the same person at all.
Right. The different drugs operate in different ways, but basically, what happens when people get into addiction is that their decisions are based on their need to feed their addiction. It's sort of like when people are sober, you know, they can be addicted to their children.
Mm-hmm.
They can be addicted to their life and to living a normal life. But drugs really attack the very base of their ability mm-hmm. to make decisions, to observe, and to really weigh consequences. And so it's all very immediate, mm-hmm. and those long-term things get sort of longer and longer away. It's very sad what happens to people.
Yeah.
We also have seen where sometimes people are able to use drugs and still maintain their children in a healthy way. They may not be as clean as we like, they may not be, but there's a dividing line that we're trying to struggle to understand all the time, where if a person is using drugs, but their children are cared for, they're healthy, they're appropriate socially, the government maybe ought to pay attention to somebody who has more needs, even though we understand there's a risk that mm-hmm. things are going to get worse.
That's a perfect top of the hour piece. We're going to take a short break. This top of the hour, we'll come back and talk about those people with additional needs and what we've done in our community to help meet those needs through our juvenile court system. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Let's Talk About It, presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services. A 5 to 6 minute highlight podcast of the same show is available on KXOradio.com.
And welcome back. You're still listening to Let's Talk About It, your wellness radio. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874. That's 337-8874.
Operators are standing by right now to take your call. Good morning. Unless you're one of those people who just tuned in which case you're going, oh, goodness, what did I miss? And I'm not going to tell you. We're listening. Our guest this morning is the honorable Judge Juan Ulloa, who is the juvenile court referee, which is really, you know, when I think about the people who give it up for the team, there's really quite a few people in our community that are just consistently dedicated to the well-being of this community, and you know, all these people could be living in La Jolla and getting up in the morning and surfing and driving their Mercedes into their nice laminate wood floor office with their gorgeous secretary and listening to KPBS. And they're not. They're here in this community. It's 110 degrees today. They're here in this community and they're coming into work every day in what other people would see as insurmountable types of social issues. I mean, this is our unemployment's 30%. We've got all of this cultural mixing going on that leaves people high and dry. We've got an education system that is what it is. And Judge Ulloa shows up every day and works with these families that are the most needy families in terms of trying to be successful in this very complex world. And you know, that's the first time I ever met him, but I'm really, really respectfully just honored to be here. And no, seriously, you give it up for the team. You could looking at the ponies in Del Mar today.
Well, what's happening is that, you know what, ever since Judge Ulloa took the chair, you know, the judge for being a juvenile court, a lot of changes have happened. And it's been since January of 2008 since he came on board.
That's right.
And things are moving. It's been a year and a half, a little bit more, but it's very different.
If this county had a Hall of Fame, this guy's name would be on the way.
I think what we want as a community is get the families together and not just, you know, put a patch on it. And okay, you know, we provided services to this youth and we did our part. That's it. You know, the youth was in trouble. He was doing the crime or he was the one, and we provide these services and, you know, well, he didn't get better. But we tried, you know.
Well, kids do get better. Families do want help. We hear about failures.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly enough, there's no way to publicize successes. But one of the changes that has occurred is that we've changed our focus now to, instead of removing children and then trying to fix families after the fact,
mm-hmm.
the biggest focus now is on preventing removal. So the Department of Social Services is trying to access services for families before they reach that emergency removal crisis
mm-hmm.
point. And that is getting them over to behavioral health, getting them to job training, getting them to housing, getting them to, you know, all the services that do exist. Our county and our government do provide a support system.
Mm-hmm.
And we're always surprised that the public doesn't know what to do. People don't know
how to access
for whatever reason that they can get help for the children in school that are struggling. They can get help for children that are having, or adults that are having psychological issues. They need some counseling, need some help, some direction, someone to talk to. That if your housing is inadequate, that you don't have to live in those conditions, that there are assistance
mm-hmm.
programs to help you get, you know, safe, adequate housing. So the Department of Social Services has done a great job. I pick on them a lot because that's my job when we come to court.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
you don't get to be great without people supporting their greatness by challenging
and pushing
them. Let me tell you, if there's people out there doing the work and the heat, those are the ones that are doing it. I sit in my office in the air conditioning. Those are the heroes. There's
mm-hmm.
the people in the departments that work, public servants that work for behavioral health services, I work for Department of Social Services, probation officers that are working with families in crisis day after day after day, one family at a time, one child at a time. You know, and we're trying to be more efficient, have a bigger view. Maria was mentioning during the break this program called Functional Families and Nurturing Families, and there's different names for it, but that is the big change.
Family.
And, you know, we look at, for example, probation as being a law enforcement where a person commits a crime, they get sentenced by the court, and it has certain things, and we have this department traditionally whose job it is to wait for them to mess up so that we can...
And pay little attention. Right.
That's
look
right.
Over their shoulders.
Look over their shoulders, wait for them to mess up, and get them back to jail.
Mm-hmm.
We're changing that. If they're on probation, then we need to find out what they need. And we're finding out the movement across the country and Imperial County Probation Department, with its new chief probation officer, Marty Cousin, is embracing this idea that we want to do things that work, not just because we've always done them.
Mm-hmm.
And the process is very simple. If there is a tool that can tell you who needs your help and who doesn't need your help, you need to have that tool. Because if you have 400 or 1,000 people that represent not only themselves but whole families in crisis, there's a certain number of those that no matter what you do for them, they're going to continue to offend. There's a very large number of those, apparently science tells us, that not only do not need your help, but the more that they maintain in contact with the criminal element and the government, could actually cause them harm. So imagine if you could take 30% of the caseloads of these overworked probation officers and say, you know what, you don't need supervision, go home, be good, we'll see you later, go back to your families. Mm-hmm. And that middle group that can actually be benefited from services, let's help them build their social support backup.
And it's like you said, it's working with a family, because it could be that you can end up with a family that, you know, the youth was the one that got in trouble. But as you go in, you see that the family has probably not been in the criminal system, but it's in crisis.
Right.
And they could use help. And if you don't get that help to those parents, then those parents could either end up in the law enforcement also, could eventually taking their kids away, and it's just broken down. Or you could also be on the other side. You know, you see these parents who are already in the criminal justice, and the child needs help. And if you don't give that assistance to that child might end up also ending up in the criminal system.
Right.
So
and
if
you get him, yeah, you get everything.
What I'm hearing you describe, Judge Yaw, is a system where, to a certain extent, within the flexibility of the legal code, one size fits all, and that was kind of, you know, every child who comes in with failure to behave appropriately at community school or whatever the transgression was, is given the same level of intervention in our previous system. And now we're starting to look at it and do some assessment work and try and figure out what level of support does this person really need.
What we've done in the past is that as they were coming into the system, regarding if it was the parent or the child, we were just taking care of them and not even looking to see what's inside their home.
Right. There's two steps. One of them is that we need to improve our ability to do the assessment. We've always done assessments. Everybody looks at a family and says, well, these are the kind of steps that are appropriate. But we haven't actually studied whether those steps are effective.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically operating on our usual practice or those hated words in government, we've always done it this way.
So every family who's ever had their children intervened with social services has always needed a parenting class, for example.
Good example. Right? So there's different devices out there. The one that the county, that probation is investing in is called assessments.com. It's, it's an actual assessment tool that teaches a diagnostic interview process so that a probation officer can interview a person and assess different levels of support that they have. And by assessing those different levels, I think there's some of the systems have 5, some have up to 12 different factors. For example, how important is it that they never finish high school? How important is it that they don't have a driver's license? How important is it that they have no friends?
So what does the probationer, what does the person value in terms of where are they willing to work?
Right. And so what you do is you get an assessment of what their needs are, and then you may find that a person that has lots of social support, that has lots of what we used to consider things to lose societally, you know, you've got a job, you've got a driver's license, you have a family, you know, you're heavily invested in behaving yourself, you probably don't need a lot of supervision. You don't need to be coming to court. You don't need to be reporting to the probation department and sitting next to the drug addict or the drug dealer, you know, and asking how the weather is. And that's exactly what happens is there are a certain number of offenders who are harmed by more intervention. They need to be on
They would naturally self-isolate. Yeah. They would stay out of harm's way if you didn't.
Right.
But then you come across one when the probation officer is doing the assessment and find out that the youth has problems, constantly arguments with family, always fighting. Grades are really low.
So you get you have a level of risk. But then by doing that, you also have an outline of what services that person needs in order to become low risk. And that's what people mean when we're saying that probation officers are changing from police officers to social workers. Probation officers, some have been police officers in the past. There's nothing wrong with police officers. They have their job.
They have to enforce the law.
But in probation, our law enforcement function is in prevention. One person, one family at a time. And that's the mindset that we're changing.
Yeah. You know. Well, I was just driving to here, and I was listening to the other radio station, San Diego, NPR. And, you know, they were saying about the governor was there saying about our prison system, that they have to reform it, that, you know, they got a cut of $1 million in cuts because of the budget. The riot that just happened, that so many, I guess, over 100 got injured.
I loved it looking like an action movie.
Yes, and it was, you know, it was overcrowded. But I think it's just, there has to be some type of reform regarding the legal system and the laws and all those. There's many people who are sent to prison that shouldn't have been sent to prison because of the laws are too tough. That's my opinion. They shouldn't be, and...
Well,
you know,
now
they're
in jail. Maybe that would work.
Well, yeah, and they're overcrowded, and maybe those people needed treatment or needed some type of help. Get them assessed. What we're going to be doing here with juvenile youth, adults also being getting assessed. And you know what? This person maybe needs to not be sent to state prison, and maybe they can benefit from some services and get the family together. You know,
There's no disagreement that we need to invest in prevention. The prison commitment is a very complicated problem that we probably wouldn't have time to talk about in an hour here.
I know.
But there's a whole range of things from prevention service to rehabilitation services to reentry issues, but also to drugs and our attitude towards people who use drugs and who sell drugs. You know, it's very expensive. We have a lot of laws that require it, but it's easier to get through USC cheaper than it is to spend a year in state prison.
Wow.
Twice.
Yes. Oh, wow.
Twice.
Can you imagine?
So it's kind of important as we look at this financial crisis. That we reassess what we're doing and see if we really are spending our dollars locally, because the different county agencies have really learned to talk to each other and to share goals and to share resources and work together. And we are unique. When I go to conferences across the state and talk to other courts and other judges and what they're doing, you know, Imperial County is unique, almost. We have a level, just because of our size, we know each other well enough and we can call each other. We have a level of cooperation and collaboration between different agencies that is unprecedented. And people are working together. We're doing more, better work with less money.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, we've come to the realization we cannot deny anymore. We cannot blame it on lack of money. Leadership is more important than money.
Mm-hmm.
And services and collaboration and understanding each other's needs is where we need to spend our energies.
And ultimately, it's the services. If they need services, the family needs services, we need to provide the services.
Absolutely.
So you know, think this is headed in two directions then? What I'm hearing is that we're getting better at figuring out who needs what, and then we're getting better at figuring out what that what is in terms of like evidence-based practices.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's our goal. The evidence-based practices is a national movement that we want to join. You know, we want to jump on that boat with both feet because what it is doing things that work and doing things that work efficiently and cheaply. We can't just continue doing what we've been doing. We know it's not working.
That's true. But it just... We can't, and another thing is that we, as government agencies, we have to be accountable on the way we spend the money, too. You know, if they're giving us the money to provide these services, you know, federal government wants, well, you know what, let's see the outcome. What is it that you did? So that is push. We have to use things that model that work, not just... Well,
that's one of our transition challenges, is that in the services business and in government generally, we have... not traditionally done what is called outcome assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know how to measure success. We can tell you, yeah, we're doing good work. I feel like I'm doing good work. Mm-hmm. I feel good when we have success. And I can tell you 3 families that I've helped. But that doesn't explain the $100,000 or $1 million that my department spent this year. And because we're not traditionally... deciding before how we're going to measure whether we succeeded or not, so that we can tell whether the things that we are doing are effective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big change, is we need to start, accountability starts with prediction.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing these things because we think they're going to cause this outcome. At the end of the day, if it's not causing this outcome, then we need to change what we're doing. Because otherwise it's a waste of money.
Yeah.
And that, there's a lot of every program that we have now is under scrutiny. Why? Because there's not enough money to go around. So when you're weighing the efficiency of a prevention or early intervention program like Peer Court and what it costs and how many people it takes versus the ability to have parenting classes for parents of delinquent youth and what that would cost versus, you know, housing a child in juvenile hall versus sending a child to a rehabilitative placement and what that costs. You can't just say, well, these are the things that we've done. You have to say, how effective is our dollar being?
Mm-hmm.
And you need to measure that. You need to see what, you know, analyze how well we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a good expenditure?
Mm-hmm.
Well, but
we love these programs. We think they're great, but can we justify them?
Can we justify them?
Well, and the other, I think the other element, the elephant in the room, if you will, is political influence because, as you mentioned, the juvenile court proceedings are confidential. Most people don't want to advertise their involvement in the juvenile court system.
Absolutely.
So they're not marching on Sacramento right now.
No.
They don't have a political lobby that's paying campaign contributions to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Not only, I think, is do we have to contend with the analysis of outcomes, which obviously is something that's very important, but somehow things that don't have political clout have to have some way of getting their foot in the door of limited government funding.
The Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of California recently, well not recently, about 4 years ago, started a Blue Ribbon Commission to review services for foster care, to try to give some publicity to children that are removed from their families and raised by the government, and what kind of services mm-hmm. we're providing for them, how well we're doing, and what can we do better. And they came up with 18 recommendations. And here in Imperial County, we have our own Blue Ribbon Committee that's trying to follow up on those recommendations and working on some of those specific issues. Because within the system, the people that do get attention are removed children mm-hmm. because nobody can deny the government's responsibility for raising a child if you've removed that child from the family.
Yeah.
You broke it, you bought
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly, and we have to do a better job. You know, so one of the issues is that with those children that are not going home, we need to do a better job of transitioning them into adulthood. And in the last couple of years, we've done a real expanded job of trying to provide services,
mm-hmm.
you know, to encourage those that have the ability to go on to college and seek careers, to encourage those that don't to find get work-related experience, there's some real-world exposure, how to protect yourself, mm-hmm. to get transitional housing, to get on your feet, to get started on your own as an adult.
And I think
instead
that's,
of just
yeah.
go back home.
Yeah, I think that, and there's been a big, they've been underserved, or that transition age youth, what it's called. You know, as soon as they're aging out of the system.
Yeah, for any of us who've raised kids, are they grown up when they're 18?
You know, they're on your own.
According to the legal system.
So, you know what, okay, yeah. You're 18, you're on your own, go. But now we're assisting them, and we're providing services. Okay, get, like you said, judges, that we're preparing them. You know, let's encourage them to go to college, get them to some transitional housing, assist them with the housing. IVRP, Project ACE, did a really good job, and I know that right now they're hurting with budget cuts in the funding, but they assisted a lot of our kids in the Imperial Valley with housing, and they not just got the housing, they got them also assisted them with a car, vehicle, to go to a job, school. They assisted them in getting them furniture for their apartments, and that was a really good program, and I know that they're hurting right now.
You know, we can't deny that helping, you know, if we know in our own families when a child is moving out of the house, what do families do for them?
We help them out, we prepare them,
we
assist
them.
You
mm-hmm. gotta get them started, and our level of support doesn't end at age 18. But when you're being raised by the government, there's a problem that we don't have those funds. So, you know, helping them find a house and get some transportation so that they can seek employment, seek education, and get on with their lives in a positive way is critical.
Mm-hmm.
Most states are moving towards expanding the support age to 21 and even to 25, you know, so that mm-hmm. gives us more of a time. But even more important than transition out is prevention mm-hmm. from coming into the system.
That's true.
Yeah, you know, that's what we're going to say.
That's where we go.
And I think that we need to do a better job of letting the community know what probation does, what social services does, and what behavioral health does, and other county agencies for families in need.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that we haven't paid attention to. The court proceedings are confidential, but the work that people do and the impact it has on the community mm-hmm. are not. And I think two things are going to happen. Probation, for example, took the first step. They have an actual public relations committee where the employees are taking it upon themselves to let the public know what their work is. At a time when they're changing their entire approach, social services and behavioral health in the county could probably do a better job of that. But I think that the public should be aware.
Wait, I thought we were the public service unit.
I'm very proud of the work that social workers, the probation officers mm-hmm. Are doing for young people and for families in crisis. We've made changes. We're in a change environment. We're never going to stop making changes. We're going to always mm-hmm. continue to be looking to do better.
It hasn't been perfected yet. Why do we think it's going to happen anytime soon?
Yeah.
It's got to keep growing.
Keep on.
Doing it better.
But our mindset has changed. I think we're in a very highly energized environment here in Imperial County with our public service departments. And every day we're improving our communication and our collaboration.
Yeah.
So we're kind of empowered to make things work now.
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
Absolutely.
Well, we have next week at in our program for our WAS, Pay and Adolescent
Ward
Dual Diagnosis.
Ward Access to Supportive Services,
Ward
Transitional Age Youth Programs, Mental Health Service Act Programs.
And Adult and Adolescent Dual Diagnosed. We're going to have Dr. Stephen Blavovic come down from back east, actually, and he's going to be training us on nurturing parenting, and it's on adolescents and parents. So those families and that are in crisis, you know, are having difficulties, that's our first step. So, and then eventually we're going to be doing that functional families. So that's our first one, and it's a series of training. So we're excited, and it's going to be a two-day training, and all of our mental health rehab techs are going to be there getting trained. So,
great. It's a good step.
Yes, it is a good step. That's our good step, finally.
But you all, it's been a pleasure having you aboard today. You want to do a bonus hour?
No.
I would
be
continue.
Happy to chat with you all day, but
I'd have to
go to work.
As do we. But it's been a pleasure having you aboard today. And
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And remember, this show can be on podcast by next week, Mario. Yes, but next week. And you can access it through www.kxoradio.com.
So all your family over in Maryland can click on the button on their internet.
No one lives in Maryland.
Not anymore, no. He's, remember, we have to, he's not a native valley act.
I know about Maryland.
But
I'm good.
Next week we will have Juan Benito, and he's going to be talking on IVRP. On one of the programs that we have a contract with IVRP and providing services to our behavioral health clients.
That's Regional Occupation Program, and that's about jobs. So you can tune in, or have all those jobless people out in the community tune in. We'll get some people employed just on that show alone.
Okay. See you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.